In September of 1862, this is still inconceivable, almost 23,000 soldiers died in the U.S. Civil War battle that took place at Antietam, Maryland. Then in early October, there were an additional 15,000 plus casualties. At that same time, the Dakota War was flaring up in Minnesota. A smallpox epidemic plagued the West, where earlier in the same year, catastrophic floods had ravaged a wide portion of that region. It was not, by any estimation, the best of times for a violently fractured nation. Readers of the Atlantic Monthly were reminded of that grim reality. Included in their October 1862 issue was a poem by John Greenleaf Whittier, acknowledging the flags of war like stormbirds fly, the charging trumpets blow, and spoke of the battle's breath of hell. So those readers might understandably have found it incongruous that this issue of the Atlantic begins with an essay entitled Autumnal Tints. Its author, better known to us now than to Atlantic readers then, was a New England writer, lecturer, surveyor, naturalist, walker, and sometimes pencil maker named Henry David Thoreau. It represented one of Thoreau's final literary efforts, its actual publication coming 6 months after his untimely death. With war raging, with battlefields in the North and the South saturated in the blood of the young, with a major portion of the population still enslaved in the South and rejected in the North, Thoreau opted to write, and the Atlantic then chose to print an essay extolling fall colors. Can you imagine? How does one sing a lovely song in a strained land? The question, who here is unaware, the question still pertains, how does one sing a lovely song in a strained land? Thoreau's acclaimed essay, one of my personally favorite pieces of his writing, drew on extensive notes intended for a much more ambitious project, one he realized as his life waned he could not possibly complete. He'd been sharing these observations as early as in a February 1859 lecture. 3 Februaries later, as Robert Richardson in his tender introduction to a recent publication of this essay explains, as the 44-year-old Henry Thoreau lay dying in his family home in Concord, Massachusetts, in the cold New England winter, he roused himself to one last great literary effort. The result is Autumnal Tints. In it, Thoreau takes us on a colorful time-lapse autumnal tour, inviting us on a long, slow, attentive walk through the streets, along forest paths, and down the languid alluvial waterways of his beloved hometown. It begins in late August. The purple grass, he writes, is now at the height of its beauty. Thoreau points out that to the attentive eye, there's a change in the tent even of grass. And the one who notices may be overcome by its beauty. Each humblest plant or weed, as we call it, stands there to express some thought or mood of our own. And so it is, he will say, in varying ways. Beauty, the beauty we take the time to notice, to really notice, breaks down the barrier between the observed and the observer. In seeing, appreciating, beauty gives expression to something deep within each of us. By the 25th of September, Thoreau notes with characteristic exactitude, the red maples generally are beginning to be ripe. He names them with an unmistakable biblical echo, burning bushes. These magnificent trees also communicating something sacred. How beautiful when a whole tree is like one great fruit, full of ripe juices, every leaf from lowest limb to topmost spire, all aglow, especially if you look toward the summit. Thoreau had grown up with the austere restraint of early Unitarianism, a religion he rejected as a young adult. He knows that tradition's suspicion of pleasure and can't resist from time to time chiding those churchgoers in his Massachusetts village. In the full flush of fall splendor, he'll remark that these dispassionate, cautious, heady religionists see the trees in their high color and just might fear that some mischief is brewing. I do not see what the Puritans did at this season, he smirks. When the maples blaze out in scarlet. They certainly could not have worshipped in groves then. Perhaps that is why they built meeting houses and fenced them round with horse sheds. Sheds. Scandalous, this shameless, outrageous beauty. Then it's the elm, those great brownish yellow masses, and then the fallen leaves that form thick beds or carpets on the ground while large fleets of leaves are floating on the surface of the Assabet River coursing through town. The trees, he remarks, are now repaying the earth with interest what they have taken from it. He's full of awe when his attention turns later in the fall to the sugar maples. As I look up the main street, they appear like painted screens, standing before the houses, glowing with yellow and red, and show unexpectedly bright and delicate tints. A man enamored of science, who learned and loved careful scientific designations, will nonetheless admit, but of much more importance than a knowledge of the names and distinctions of color, is the joy and exhilaration which these colored leaves excite. Oh, then comes the scarlet oak. There they dance arm in arm with the light so that you can hardly tell at last what in the dance is leaf and what is light. As his walk fit into the parameters of this essay draws to its end, Thoreau proffers a broader observation. There is just as much beauty visible to us in the landscape as we are prepared to appreciate. There's just as much beauty available to us in the landscape as we are prepared to appreciate. It's an observation echoed a few decades later by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who, writing his own autumnal poem, will exclaim, these things were here, and but the beholder wanting. Beauty is here. Beauty is always here to be seen and heard and felt and tasted and smelled, to be noticed and listened to and taken in fully into the very soul of our souls. There's as much beauty available as we are willing to appreciate. At the core of all that he offers in this piece, Henry David Thoreau is addressing a deep and unrelenting human need. To be sure, we must have, as he calls them, the fruits which we eat. But it's not enough. We have, he recognizes, our taste for beauty alone. Our taste for beauty alone. Most assuredly, a part, an essential part of what it means to be human is the hunger and thirst for beauty. Just as inadequate nutrition weakens and withers our bodies, so too, without seeing and noticing and appreciating and magnifying beauty, we wither our souls. We need beauty as surely as we need food. We cannot be human without beauty. Betty Saar is a remarkable contemporary artist, now in her 90s, an early and exemplary participant in the Black Arts Movement. Her art is occasionally mystical, spiritual, but more often is wry, clever, satirical. It was through her piece, The Liberation of Aunt Jemima, that many first discovered her art. In an NPR interview for her 80th birthday, Saar admitted that much of what she is creating is informed by anger about the segregation and the racism in our country. But it's not enough. Not for Betty Saar. So she continued, that's the part that's essential, to have beauty. Mystery and beauty, Saar says, remain constant forces behind my creative energy. To a war-torn nation, more fractured than it had ever been, Thoreau offered beauty. Beauty as he found it, beauty as he expressed it. He offered it because we have a taste for beauty alone. He offered it because even when social ills loom large, even in times that are exasperating, even or maybe especially when things are so unnerving, we need beauty. It's not a luxury. It's not an adornment. It's not an indulgence. Beauty is essential. It is food for our hungry souls. One of you reminded me just this week how Alice Walker expressed that in The Color Purple. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. On the off chance that we've gotten this universalism thing wrong, you really don't want to piss God off. During a week when we mark the 100th birthday of the high priest of Bebop, North Carolina native Thelonious Monk, I've been listening to Monk every morning. In such unexpected, unorthodox ways, Monk made and makes the world a more beautiful place. Every day, along with breakfast, a little more sustenance for my hungry soul. And you? Where are you noticing and hearing and appreciating beauty these days? Some of you have heard me commend recently a practice of greeting each other, not with a disinterested, "How are you?" but with a fully interested, "Where are you finding beauty these days?" To be sure, we are here. We exist as a spiritual community to stare unflinchingly into the face of the worst we humans do to one another. This can never be a sanctuary where we ignore or avoid the social ills of our times. We must, in order to be who we say we are, we must notice the brokenness and hear loudly and clearly the cries of the broken. But not just that. Never only that. This must also be a place that is calling us again and again to notice and appreciate and magnify beauty, because there is never a time when that is not needed. The pioneering African American biologist Ernest Everett Just, sounding for all the world like a student of Thoreau's, recognized, "We feel the beauty of nature because we are a part of nature." So an autumnal stroll through a kaleidoscopic landscape gives us not just an experience of external beauty. It reconnects us to the deepest, most essential, most natural parts of who we are. Listen. Pay attention. Don't ignore, don't avoid the pain that is so real in this time. But all the while, don't forget your hungering soul. Feed sumptuously your taste for beauty alone.